Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic for this week is adolescent eating disorders, anorexia nervosa, bulimia, binge eating, and there's a new one that you perhaps have not heard of, avoidative restrictive food intake disorder. Our guest is Dr. Ellen Rome. She's head of adolescent medicine at the Cleveland Clinic Children's Hospital. And what we hope to do today is help you understand these problems, discuss whom and why they seem to occur, and what can be done to treat them. If you have questions during the next hour or so, let me give you a couple of ways to get in touch with us. In Anchorage, our number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. In addition to being head of adolescent medicine at the Cleveland Clinic, Dr. Rome is also professor of pediatrics with the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine at Case. And she's on a number of adolescent health and medicine and eating disorder organizations and committees, as well as on the American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Adolescence. Dr. Rome, it's a pleasure to have you join us today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Let's start by talking a little bit about the basics of energy. What leads to weight gain, what leads to weight loss, and how that relates to what we do during the day and what we eat as a source of energy.
So when we think about eating disorders and obesity, there's a fine line often between the two, and we're trying to aim for that balance of wellness somewhere in between. And when you think about eating disorders, they can come in different shapes and sizes. We get extremely worried when we see somebody go from 120 pounds to 80 pounds, but we might cheer, and often, unfortunately, inappropriately, when somebody goes from 220 to 180. The challenge is you can have the same problems and consequences medically of dieting or doing harm to body when one goes from that 120 to 80, and it can be the same going from 220 to 180, but it's invisible when it starts from somebody who's deemed obese or overweight to start. So the world is saying, go, that's great, you just lost a bunch of weight. And that person may have done the same harmful strategies that the skinny person did. Mm-hmm. So we worry when energy intake is insufficient to meet the body's needs. That's the challenge of eating disorders. When what you take in isn't enough or in the right balance of food groups to meet your body's energy needs. When we think about obesity, it's usually the reverse equation. You're getting in more than your body's needs are, or more in the wrong balance than what your body requires. And for instance, we know that when you overfeed a baby or a toddler, by the time the child is 1.5, 2, or 3 years old, they know to pick more, to choose to eat more than their body's energy needs. These eating patterns can get established very, very young and can be a challenge to address. We're invested in making sure we're helping people build great eating habits from the get-go and avoid eating disorders of under-eating or even, you know, the other spectrum, binge eating disorder, eating more than you need with associated guilt and other consequences.
So one of the points I think I hear you saying is that a lot of these problems may have their origins in early behaviors in infancy and toddlers in how they relate to food and how they use food related to behavior.
We can set some of those patterns early on. And just we can help toddlers learn to, on the 87th attempt at feeding peas and the kid still doesn't want them, we may not succeed in getting that kid to like peas, but if we can get them to eat something else green that would be just as good and pea-like in nutrients, bonus. So from early on, helping parents to not engage in food battles, but to have meals be part of an enjoyable moment or moments of their day can be a gift that families can enjoy and can benefit the kids nutritionally from early childhood onward.
I'm going to take a second because I think this is really important, not only from an eating problem standpoint, but from all behaviors. We've really become, it's become clear that early childhood experiences have lifelong consequences. And I've been using a model to help people understand that. So I'd like to use that or describe it and see if you agree or not. And what I've been doing is telling people, we now know that the brain is a remarkable learning organ. It learns amazingly well. It is not good at unlearning. So, for example, once you learn to ride a bike, you can't tell me I'm going to go unlearn how to ride a bike or even describe how that might be done. And so as a consequence, particularly early in life, what we learn sets up kind of permanent circuits that are maybe in a sense always there, but certainly the more they're reinforced, the more we do it, the harder it is to change those circuits. Is that what I'm hearing you say is related to feedings and food?
Yeah. Yes, and we can also add genes into this mix, and the consequences of nature and nurture. Okay. If somebody has family members who are who have suffered from eating disorders, that person may be more likely to pass on that gene. So you put that child through a starvation mode, and the adaptive response may be to develop an eating disorder. And in the same way, if a child is chronically overfed and they happen to be from a whole skinny genes family, they may have less consequence to that overfeeding than the child who's overfed in the face of a gene pool that makes obesity a likely downstream body type.
Yep. So the good point. So it's very hard to tease out the environment and the genes, the nature nurture argument. For most things, we now think it's a combination or interrelationship that's occurring in a lot of disorders.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks. Let me remind listeners once again, my guest is Dr. Ellen Rome. We're talking about adolescent eating disorders. If you have questions or comments, our local number 550-8433, and over the next 50 minutes or so, you can reach us by email at line1, and you have to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1 at alaskapublic.org. Well, let's define, if you don't mind, what we mean by eating disorder, and then we'll get into specific ones.
Okay. So eating disorders are when they're complex biopsychosocial disorders that cause predictable responses to brain and body. And there's a couple of different ones. There's anorexia nervosa, and that one is characterized by severe caloric restriction with a fear of weight gain and a distorted body image that causes people to lose weight inappropriately or fail to gain weight if it's a little kid who's supposed to be growing. The main features for anorexia nervosa are restricting energy intake relative to requirements so that you're significantly lower weight for your age, your sex or developmental stage, and significantly low weight is defined as a weight that is less than minimally normal, or for kids, less than that which should be expected. With anorexia, you also have an intense fear of gaining weight or of becoming fat, or persistent behavior that interferes with weight gain, even though they're already at a low weight. And there's a disturbance in the way in which one's body weight or shape is experienced, with undue influence of body weight or shape on self-evaluation. They don't like how they feel they look. This is in contrast to bulimia nervosa, which is defined by the binges, not the purges. So patients with bulimia will engage in episodic binge eating, where they're eating more than that they need to the point of guilt, and then they'll compensate, such as restricting or starving, self-induced vomiting or lacks of abuse to compensate for the weight gain. And what's new in DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual 5th edition, it's kind of the Bible for psychiatric and mental health diagnoses, is that it used to be that to get a label of bulimia, you needed to binge and purge or compensate twice a week for at least 3 months. What we've shown is now you only need once a week for 3 months to make that diagnosis, because clinically and epidemiologically, once a week, twice a week, if it's been going on 3 months at that level, outcomes are the same, impact on the body is the same, and treatments are the same. Moving on, the newest one, avoidant or restrictive food intake disorder, those are the kids that don't sound like anorexia or bulimia. And they're kids that have might have gagged or choked and never want to vomit again. So they start avoiding food so that they don't have that bad outcome. They're kids who have been a picky eater and all of a sudden cut out even more food groups, so it's even harder to get them getting enough in. It's kids who may have had something happen, you know, physically where suddenly they can't eat the same way, or they get an illness or have a surgery and lose some weight and then kind of have to retrain themselves back to eating again. And the challenge is with ARFID, or this avoidant or restrictive food intake disorder, their physiology can be the same as anorexia nervosa. They can have extremely life-threatening medical complications, but the pediatrician or the family member can ask them, you know, so do you think you're fat? Do you want to gain weight? And they'll say, no, I don't think I'm fat. I'm too skinny, and I'd love to be gaining, but that gaining isn't so easy. So ARFID is this new thing that's the overly skinny person who has either failed to gain or has lost weight but does not have eating disorder mindset. Then there's also the other types. For instance, atypical anorexia nervosa. Those are the people that sound and look like somebody with anorexia nervosa, except they haven't lost the weight yet. It's still either within or above normal range for that person's age. We also have subclinical bulimia nervosa, which means they haven't been binging and compensating for once a week for at least 3 months. And then we also have other things such as binge eating disorder, which means they don't do the purges, they just do the binges.
Are other emotional, psychiatric kinds of problems like depression and anxiety and maybe drug and alcohol abuse often cofactors or coexistent with these problems?
These coexistent illness can happen. So, for instance, you could have somebody who has obsessive compulsive disorder and anorexia nervosa, or you might have somebody who's just a little obsessive or compulsive about their eating issues, but you treat the eating disorder and the obsessive compulsive symptoms melt away. So when you're thinking about mental health and eating disorders, you have to kind of figure out what's the iceberg and what's the tip of the iceberg. So, for instance, say somebody's very, very, very depressed or very, very anxious to the point where they have their iceberg is either major depression or anxiety disorder. The tip of the iceberg may be the eating disorder, how it's showing up with the eating disorder serving as their coping strategy. And take away the eating disorder, take away the tip of that iceberg, and you've still got a whole iceberg to melt. So then you really have to figure out what else is going on underlying and help melt that iceberg for that individual child or adolescent or young adult patient. And I'm a pediatrician that specializes in teenage health, so in this whole conversation, I'm going to be talking more about the kid perspective. Mm-hmm. But as you know, eating disorders really do happen over the whole lifespan. My expertise is in the younger set, but really, you can see eating disorder happen new in somebody in a nursing home, somebody in middle age, somebody in young adulthood, not just in childhood.
And there's this conception or preception that it's much more common in women than men. Is that true?
We're seeing more and recognizing more illness in guys as well. Women still have more, but if you look at anorexia nervosa, and if anorexia is happening in 1 out of 100 girls on average, we're finding that our cases of anorexia, the girl-to-guy ratio can be as high as 1 to 3 or 1 to 12, depending on who's research you're reading. When we looked at our eating disorder patients from a national collaborative that involves adolescent medicine centers with expertise in special treatment and recognition of eating disorder patients, we found that in all of our sites around the country, and as well as one in Canada, we were seeing about a 17% boy prevalence. You know, that means that 17 out of every 100 eating disorder kids were male. When we looked at ARFID, it was as much as 1 in 4 were male. So we're recognizing it better in boys. The challenge is with boys, often they go undiagnosed longer, so they've lost more weight and are sicker by the time they're recognized. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to help families and pediatricians identify red flags for their boy or girl to know that if their parent's spider sense is tingling, it's time to seek help. And if they're not getting answers that are useful, go beyond their where they initially go to figure out what else is going on with my kid.
Let me just take a second to remind listeners once again, this is Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest is Dr. Ellen Rome. She's head of the adolescent medicine at Cleveland Clinic, and we're talking about adolescent eating disorders. If you've got questions or comments or prayer experiences even with eating disorders and you'd like to comment or ask questions, this is an excellent time to ask an authority on these issues. Our local number again, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So let's ask you to talk about some of these red flags that you mentioned in an effort to maybe try to head this off before it gets harder to treat.
So if a parent has any worry that their kid may have an eating disorder, that itself is a red flag. If any adult or peer of the kid comes in saying, my kid may, I'm worried that this kid has an eating disorder, that is worth taking seriously. And the odds are that if a kid doesn't have an eating disorder at that point in time, they're at risk for developing one in the near future. So whenever anyone is concerned about a kid with an eating disorder, take that worry seriously. If a parent feels blown off by their family doc or their pediatrician who says, oh, no, the kid's fine, but they're still worried about it, ask again or go on one of the recommended websites or seek help from somebody who's got special training in eating disorders to just say, hey, here's what I'm seeing. Do I need to worry about this? What can I do in the meanwhile? So that you can become an educated parent or caregiver and help nip something in the bud. What we know is that when the disordered eating behaviors get hardwired, they're a lot harder to fix. So recognition early really does carry some weight and adds value.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Dr. Rome, we have a caller. I want to take that call. Scott, you're on line one.
Yes.
Hi, Scott.
Hi. I'm 54, and I have a eating disorder, which is pretty scary. And I don't know if the heart attacks, but I've gone from 168 pounds, and I now today weigh 111, and I'm really scared about my health, and I'm having a hard time trying to gain this weight back.
Sky, I feel your pain. That's a scary place to be in. Do you have a team locally that you can that you're seeing? Somebody who's a medical doc versed in eating disorders, somebody who's a dietitian, somebody who's a therapist, and a psychiatrist, or a local eating disorder resource team?
Yes, I do. And everybody's saying to eat more, but it's more than that, and I just can't put my finger on it. It's extremely difficult.
So you're a little out of my age range, because I am a pediatrician. But what I would suggest is partnering with your team, and if it means you need to seek out a day treatment program or a residential treatment center versed in eating disorders, where you can relearn how to eat and do that self-care, it usually takes a team approach, and these treatment programs can really do a nice job. Some of the ones that take men include Rogers Memorial Hospital in Wisconsin and Eating Recovery Center in Denver. It may be worthwhile looking on the NIDA website to figure out which is the one closest to you.
Okay. Okay.
And I wish you all success in your recovery. And have hope. People can recover from eating disorders at all ages and stages.
Thank you very much, and I'm sorry, I didn't hear the part where you were a pediatrician.
No problem, Scott. And that NIDA is the National Eating Disorders Association, and there's a link at alaskapublic.org, the Line 1 program today, that'll help you get to that if you need a way to get to it.
May you stay young at heart and eat enough to keep your heart healthy, too.
I will. And thank you so much for the information. It's a big help.
All right, good luck, Scott.
Thank you, folks.
Let's perhaps, based on that, listeners may be wondering, what are the significant health consequences of particularly anorexia nervosa?
That's a great question. The biggest ones we worry about are for brain, bone, and heart, not necessarily in that order. If you starve your body, your heart can lose muscle mass, and you can actually weaken your heart to the point where add a little bit of an electrolyte imbalance, like low potassium, or add caffeine or stimulation or an attention deficit disorder medicine or recreational drug that's a stimulant, then that heart can actually stop or develop a life-threatening arrhythmia. So the biggest thing we worry is loss of heart muscle mass. So less heart, and arrhythmias that can be life-threatening. So we really worry heart-wise when somebody gets their heart rate below 60 in the face of an eating disorder. And I'm going to dwell on heart for a second just because it's so important. We worry when heart is weakened it's not at, you know, so say somebody comes in and they said, oh, well, my kid's an athlete. And their heart rate's in the 40s, but so was, you know, LeBron James's, or I used to use Lance Armstrong, but that's less appealing to the young set now than maybe LeBron. So their heart rate's a nice athletic heart, but, you know, the kid's lost from 50 pounds in the last 6 months and is underweight and has a malnourished heart. The difference is, LeBron James' heart, you know, as he's playing in the playoffs and is eating great and playing well, is a nice, juicy, big, strong heart muscle, pumping really well. And when you look at that EKG, there's a lot of heart muscle to depolarize and then repolarize. So that's the little peak that you see on the EKG when you're looking at it. With an anorexic person's heart, there's not much heart muscle, so there's only a little bit to depolarize and repolarize. So it's a weakened heart. So that rate is slow because there's not much muscle there to move through or to, you know, to have the message conduct. So we worry about that and having that heart just stop. With other parts of eating disorder, brain, if you starve the brain long enough, it can shrink. You can get what we call cortical atrophy, and you can lose some of that brain power. The other piece is you can not learn as effectively. We'll find people who've been having starved brain come in saying that their concentration is off. They're reading the same paragraph, trying to do homework over and over and over again without getting it. So we see brain effects. We see bone effects in childhood and adolescence. You're supposed to be depositing a lot of your bone. In fact, for girls from 14 to 16, for boys from 15 to 17, you're supposed to be depositing 2/3 or 40 to 60% of your bone, peak bone mass. And so if you fail to deposit that bone at those critical stages, you can set yourself up for osteoporosis later. People can also lose bone in these stages and not just fail to put it down, but be picking it up more than depositing it. So if you think of it as a bone bank, they're making withdrawals rather than payments to that bone bank, and that can be a real setup for osteoporosis. So those are the three big ones, but literally every organ system is affected. When we think about the GI system, the gastrointestinal system, the body's smart. It tries to slow down movement from the mouth out to the other end so that it can catch every morsel of nutrition in the face of starvation. So that means that somebody with a slow GI tract will have more time for water to get drawn off in the bowel, so that'll make it more constipated or compact, more gas to be made in breakdown of food products, so they're more bloaty or, you know, feeling bloated between meals. We can have patients will describe it as having a food baby between meals. And that can be really, really uncomfortable. It can also lead to acid reflux what they'll call wet burps, when you get backwash into your mouth, and you can have a weakened lower esophageal sphincter because that muscle is not as strong either. Endocrine system slows down. People can feel sluggish or like they're not quite feeling well, and constipated and dry skin as well. But literally every organ system of the body is affected in starvation.
All right. We are approaching halfway through the program. This is the typical time. I'll try to take a short break. I think we should go ahead and do that, and then we'll come back. We have another caller, and I want to get into some options for treatment and what's the natural history of these disorders if we do nothing. So, you know, remind you, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection, our local number 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and then continue our discussion of adolescent eating disorders with Dr. Ellen Rome. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're discussing adolescent eating disorders, anorexia nervosa, bulimia, binge eating, also a newer disorder that's I'm looking for the name of it. I'm lost.
ARFID, avoidant or restrictive food intake disorder.
Yeah, avoidant and restrictive. That. Thank you, Ellen. I had not heard of that, so I did not have it in my notes. So if you've got questions or comments, we'd like you to give us a call. 550-8433 is our local number. 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. And we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And again, remember, if you're listening between 9 and 10 p.m. on a Monday evening, that's a taped recording, and we won't be able to address your questions. You can always go back to alaskapublic.org, find the Line 1 link, and you'll find the program that you can listen to again in our archives. Also, I want to mention that we will probably end this program just a couple minutes early today, as Dr. Rome has an appointment that she needs to attend to. Let's take one more caller right now, if we could. Marie, you're on line one.
Hi. I was diagnosed years and years ago with an eating disorder and went through treatment for it. And then my daughter, who as a young teen also was diagnosed with an eating disorder, is now attending college 4,000 miles away. And my concern is that when she was diagnosed, her heart rate was 40 beats a minute. It was really low. And she's seeing a therapist, but I'm wondering, should we have her heart tested? Is there something that we could do or that we should do to make sure that she's sound?
Good question.
Physically.
Thank you for that question. It brings up a brilliant point. The heart structurally is normal. So we don't have to get echoes. We don't have to get fancy tests. But you really do need an EKG initialing and then potentially ongoing, because the rate matters. And when the heart is starved, it can do a predictable set of abnormal rhythms, the most common of which is called prolonged QT. And when somebody has a QTC, a corrected QT interval that's a certain amount long, that usually means a hospital stay for acute medical stabilization. So with your daughter, you can get her even 4,000 miles away in College Health to get an EKG. And if the QTC is over 450, that usually means a hospital stay. And just as, you know, for the record, some adults may have a QTC that's slightly higher, that can happen, but with in the face of a weakened heart, it becomes one of those abnormal rhythms that can be life-threatening.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
So as treatment progresses with, for example, her daughter, if she's doing well, then we might also see the heart rate go back towards a normal level. Is that another, maybe more simple? I'm not trying to talk out of the EKG, but would it be reasonable to assume if the heart rate goes back up that things are better?
Yes. You do see, and apologies for the background noise for a second. You do see heart rate fixing just with proper eating. So if you're, and by the way, God bless you for having a daughter successful enough to get to college. That's a wonderful thing. Sometimes with eating disorders, college has to get put on hold in order to make sure she's feeding brain and rest of body appropriately. And that detour that may be life-changing and life-saving can be a necessary detour. But so with the heart, the biggest treatment for this isn't medicines. It's going to be eating again. And eating the right amounts in the right schedule, and getting that in and not having any purging behaviors that get rid of it. And purging can mean not just restricting, but vomiting, diet pills, laxatives, diuretics, other things that are very, very life-threatening, especially in the face of starvation.
Okay. Marie, are you still there?
I am. And thank you so much for that information. She's doing well now. She has good days and bad days. Like I said, I was diagnosed with this when I was 19. I've been dealing with this for over three decades.
Yeah.
And I know that she's going to be doing that probably as well, but she's hanging in there, and I just want to make sure that she's not damaged herself,
right.
Into something that needs to be treated immediately. So thank you for taking my call.
Right.
Oh, my pleasure, and best wishes for the both of you. Thank you.
All right, let's go ahead and take one more caller as well. Christy, you're on line one.
Hi there. I am a mom of a beautiful 9-year-old girl who has severe food allergies. And in January, she had her first real anaphylactic, frightening reaction and had to go to the hospital and an ambulance and all that noise. And since then, food has become a bit of an issue. I think she's looking for a little more control over it. So she wasn't eating at school for a while. She only wanted to eat at home and with me or her dad there, stuff like that. She's now eating at school again, but a friend of mine who's a therapist was like, you need to tread very carefully because this is how food disorders start. And so I guess I'm looking for some tips.
Right.
Besides, like the only thing my husband and I have done is basically not pushed her at all about food. And we know we don't make her finish her vegetables, or we don't tell her, no, you can't eat chips. You have to finish your sandwich. Like, we just let her make all her decisions about food. We just put it out on the table. But other than that, is there something else we could do to help her not, get
right.
too crazy about food?
Right. Great question.
So this is a great question. This is the exact setup for ARFID, or this avoidant or restrictive food intake disorder, and how you do tread lightly but positively can be the difference between developing ARFID or not at all and moving on to just perfect health and wellness. So ways to be careful include making sure that with what she chooses and what she likes and what she can eat safely without fear of anaphylaxis, you're getting a balance of foods in. This is true for the kid without anaphylaxis who just only eats white things or never eats green things or doesn't like things that have fat in them or doesn't like carbs or, watched one of the media things promoting health that got them so that they will eat no animal products. There's a bazillion reasons kids can start avoiding certain foods. What you want to do is make sure that they're getting a balance. And what I mean by that is we're aiming for 5-a-day fruits and veggies. We're aiming, if they won't do that, making sure they're getting a multivitamin and maybe, fruit juice or some other way to substitute and get the fiber somehow else. If they're, as far as protein, you need 2 to 3 servings of protein a day. And a protein can mean 3 slices of lunch meat or cheese or 3 ounces of nuts, which would be kind of 2 big, if you put your hands together from thumb to thumb, that would count as 3 ounces, whereas 1 handful would be 1 ounce of nuts. 2 tablespoons of peanut butter or other nut butter would count as a serving of protein. A three-ounce or fifth size a piece of chicken or fish or tofu or whatever else would count as protein. Fat grams periodically go out of fashion thanks to our health-conscious society and obesity avoidance society. But the under 26-year-old brain needs a minimum of 30 to 50 grams of fat a day, and most kids are really aiming for 50 to 90 grams of fat a day. So if you have a kid where a parent has had a heart attack or a stroke, and everyone's gone heart healthy in the diet, getting those adequate fat grams in can be a challenge. So figuring out ways to make sure that that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So we've done, and calcium, the under 10-year-old would need usually about 3 servings of calcium a day. It doesn't have to be milk. It could be kale. It could be soy. It could be almond milk or coconut milk or rice milk. It doesn't have to be dairy for the family where the kid has a dairy intolerance or allergy, for whatever reason the kids decided and the parents are okay with the kid being dairy-free. With other things, by the time with calcium and vitamin D, by the time you're hitting puberty, it ought to be 4 servings a day, or about 1,200 to 15 milligrams of calcium and about 800 to 1,000 milligrams of vitamin D. That's Nutrition 101 in a nutshell.
So we just make sure we feed her.
So make sure you feed her without making it food battles, and make sure that she's getting a balance of food in. So say you've got a kid who doesn't eat fish but will eat a burger. If the family's having fish, parallel cook a burger without making too much fuss over it.
Okay. So that's what we try to do, is just minimize our fuss. And so far, this is all we need to do. We feed her a very balanced diet. I find that if I just put it out on the table and don't even mention it, she'll either eat it, she'll eat a lot more than if I tell her, do you want a snack? And then she'll always say no.
So that's a perfect strategy. You know your child, and as long as she's getting the balance in and following her growth curve when you visit the pediatrician regularly, then you're doing a beautiful job.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Have a good day.
All right. Find us if you need us, if you start having worries.
Okay.
All right. Let me remind listeners again that this is Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest is Dr. Ellen Rome. She's head of adolescent medicine at the Cleveland Clinic Children's Hospital. But we're talking primarily about adolescent eating disorders. If you've got questions or comments, I can call us at our local number. We'll be here another 15 minutes or so, 550-8433, 550-8433. We have an email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. What about sports and eating disorders? We've heard a lot about that with females, but I wonder about wrestlers sometimes in other sports.
It's not just wrestlers that we worry about, but boy, they are one of the predisposing sports because of trying to make weight. We see eating disorders in many of the visual sports. So wrestling, gymnastics, skating, all of those ones, ballet, that cheerleading, where body image has importance in the aesthetics of the sport. That can put extra pressure on kids to perform and extra stress to have a certain body type. We also see eating disorders in the other sports, though, in soccer, in field hockey, in every other sport, you can still see it. And, in fact, when you look at college athletes, two-thirds of athletes in some studies have shown evidence of disordered eating attitudes or behaviors. So it's a risk, and we want athletes to not compromise their health habits for the sake of performance, because the problem is when you really go down the path of an eating disorder, it does interfere with your sport and your best self performance.
Okay. If you're okay with this, Dr. Rome, let's move towards treatment. But before we talk about treatment, I'd like to ask about the natural history of these disorders untreated. And my reasoning is, you know, if we want to know if a treatment works, then we have to be much better than what's happening from a natural history standpoint. So what do we know about untreated anorexia and bulimia and maybe even the restrictive eating disorders? What happens to them if we don't address them?
It's a great question, and we don't know a lot about that, because some people, you know, anecdotally, will have parents say, well, I had an eating disorder when I was a child, and I just got over it. But then you'll have another person saying that their distant cousin died of this illness. So we know that eating disorders are the most lethal of the mental health illnesses, the highest mortality rate stems from eating disorders, you know, higher than simple depression, higher than any other mental health illness. And we have not yet teased out what happens completely when you don't treat them. We have no data yet on long-term studies for things like ARFA that only became an official diagnosis in May of 2013. Mm-hmm. So we do have some early data on what seems like it helps. So when you think about eating disorder recovery as a whole, we think about it in the rule of thirds. A third of people will get better and walk away and have normal lives and healthy, happy outcomes. A third of people will get better, but when they're stressed, they'll click into abnormal eating attitudes and behaviors. And a third of people will have a chronic and relapsing course, with 1% to 25% of that group dying early of their illness. So our goal is to get more people up to that top third.
All right. So what things have been tried? What efforts have been tried to treat these disorders, and where do we stand now on what's felt to be the gold standard or the best approaches?
For the under 18-year-old with a restrictive eating disorder, so anorexia nervosa, atypical anorexia nervosa, and also ARFID, we found that something called the Modlin method works best. What the Modlin method means is parent-based receiving. And that means you put parents in charge of the meal and making sure that, and the parents making sure that 100% of all meals are getting consumed. And when parents do a pure Modlin approach, it comes in stages. You'll often have somebody doing Modlin coaching with the parent. And in Modlin stage one, the parent is in charge of everything, 100% of all meals. Modlin stage two, you put the kid in charge of one snack or meal with the parent kind of watching to make sure that they're doing it well. And as they progress through stage two, then there's more and more meals that the kid is in charge of with parents' guidance. And by stage three, the kids are working more towards independent eating and full recovery.
And I assume, and by the way, we for listeners, we have a link again at on our website at Line One, at the Alaska Public Org website. If you find today's program, you'll find a link to that program as well as another link about an organization involved in treatment. So I guess what happens is parents get trained in how to do this and how to monitor this with specialists in this area.
Yes, and so with parents, if you have nobody who knows how to do Modlin coaching, you can find actually how-to manuals online.
Okay.
So, for instance, the www.modlinparents.org website is a beautiful means of figuring out what are we supposed to do, and there's other articles or other things to do. Jim Locke and Daniel LaGrange wrote a book, Help Your Teenager Beat an Eating Disorder. It's been out for quite some time. It's a wonderful how-to manual on how do I feed my child and help my child recover. So there's newer books out as well, and those are findable on that www.modlinparents.org website. And the FEAST website is also a useful resource. That's the website of Families Empowered in Supporting Treatment of Eating Disorders.
Mm-hmm.
So these are some means to help navigate the different levels of care. With an over-18-year-old, sometimes we'll still do Modlin-based or family-based refeeding. That's sometimes still the best way to get a kid brain-fed better. What we've also found out is all the talk therapy doesn't work until the brain is better fed. So you have to have substrate or building blocks for the brain before you can hardwire healthier neural pathways. So we attend to the eating first. Sometimes when you have a patient who's just in complete panic mode over the food, medicines on the short term can be a big help. And that's part of building the team to help with the care of your child or adolescent with an eating disorder, so that you can have somebody attending to what medicines may help, somebody attending to the physical needs, the medical part, somebody attending to the emotions that go with it, and really making it a team-based approach.
It's just so common sense. I hadn't thought about it. So just to reiterate your point, too, the nutrition is improved. Psychotherapy is probably not going to be that helpful.
Correct.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Elegantly simple, but hard to do.
Yeah, that's true of a lot of things, isn't it? You didn't mention bulimia in the treatment.
Evidence-based treatment for bulimia, behavioral modification plus insight is a whole modality that's called DBT, dialectic behavioral therapy. That is one strategy, sometimes in conjunction with medicines, and again, that team approach to ensure that the person is meeting their energy needs
and not depriving themselves or restricting. Because what happens is when you restrict the brain, that brain will drive itself to fuel the binge, to make that binge happen. So you need to attend to the meal still, and also to the patterns of eating, and help the person identify situations where a binge feels inevitable or where a purge feels mandatory, so that they're hardwiring better behavior patterns for themselves.
All right. I have an email that came in, and don't let me interrupt you if you want to say more about treatment, but I want to try to get this question asked as well. And this is the author says, have you seen children who present with symptoms of obsessive compulsive-like eating habits, perhaps because of larger mental health spectrum issue? So it's a little bit ambiguous as to where they're going with this question, but would OCD-like eating habits be a symptom of some other mental health issue is what the question is.
So you can see OCD as manifesting as an eating disorder, or you can see obsessive compulsive features for somebody who truly has just the eating disorder part. It can happen both ways. So the OCD may be the iceberg, or the obsessive compulsive habits may be just how that eating disorder is showing up. And it can happen either way. So when you have somebody with disordered eating, who's got obsessive compulsive traits, that's the kind of person where once the brain has started being fed, the category of medicines called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, can really be a big help. And helping the brain have enough serotonin and in the right amounts won't change the kid's baseline personality, but can help them avoid some of those obsessive or compulsive features.
Okay. All right. I'm going to ask you, if you don't mind, just one more question, then we're going to let you leave a little early. And this may be in the relationship of myths, but I don't know the answer. I like to address myths. But if asked, I would think particularly a girl, but maybe even a boy who is suffering from an eating disorder, is at higher risk of abuse as a child, perhaps sexual and or physical. Is that necessarily true?
Not necessarily. And what we see is that eating disorders often serve the purpose of being a coping strategy, a maladaptive coping strategy, not particularly a healthy coping strategy, but a coping strategy. And the victim of abuse, sexual, physical, emotional abuse, doesn't matter. All victims of abuse need to figure out some really, really, really healthy coping strategies in order to survive. And people with eating disorders often stumble on the unhealthy eating disorder strategy rather than a much more useful set of coping skills. So we know that by age 20, one out of four girls and one out of six guys has been sexually abused. If you pull those stats, and frankly, in our practice, we've found that to be pretty true, and the girls are fairly horrified by the boy statistics, and the boys by the boy statistics. But boys often are fairly silent about abuse, and a cycle can perpetuate. Mm-hmm. So we haven't found a higher than 1 in 4 for girls, or a higher than 1 in 6 for boys prevalence of abuse in eating disorder patients. There was one study with bulimia that showed that the prevalence may be as high as 1 out of 2 patients, but that was only one study, and the other studies have shown it to be more like 1 out of 4. So we're not seeing that stat play true, so it seems more myth than fact that sexual abuse is higher in eating disorder patients. But sexual abuse definitely can happen in eating disorder patients, just as in patients who are looking for love in all the wrong places, or substance abusing to self-medicate, or other coping strategies that are not so healthy for them.
At least the bottom line is these problems of abuse are not that uncommon.
Yes, we need to remember about them, and we need to help patients make healthy lifestyle choices that are better for stress reduction than an eating disorder would be.
Yeah. Or experimenting with things that make you feel better that you are drugs that can do the same in an effort to try to do the same thing.
Exactly.
All right. Dr. Rome, I want to say very much, or my appreciation very much for taking the time with us. I know you need to scoot off to another meeting, so thanks again for taking the time.
So my pleasure, and thank you for having me here.
It's been enjoyable. Thank you.
All right. Good luck to all of you out there, and may you find the resources and the recovery that's there for you for the asking.
All right. Take care of yourself.
Best wishes to all. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. If you'd like to continue the conversation on adolescent eating disorders, you can always join KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link on our website, www.alaskapublic.org, where you can also find those Line 1 archives I've been mentioning, and the links to programs from links to various bits of information from our program today. Next week, we take a break for Memorial Day. The following Monday, June 1st, we're going to be back, and we'll enter the world of healthcare economics, try to understand what they can do to help us make better healthcare decisions. We're going to be discussing the current and future costs of childhood obesity to Alaska and Alaskans with Musheen Gutabi, who is a doctor of economics at the Institute of Social and Economic Research at UAA. So why not tune into your health and learn more that Monday, June 1st on FM 91.1. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and audio engineer. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.